to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. We're now on episode number 738. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Grays Lake, Illinois, back again to record another podcast episode. It's been a while since I've recorded one from the studio. We did a whole series down in Atlanta, Georgia at Reformed Theological Seminary. I did one in Columbia that aired last week in podcast time. That was great, meeting with the brothers and sisters in Bogota again and being able to record a podcast this time. But I'm back to normal, and we have with us one of our longtime contributors and friends, co-founder of Reform Forum, Jeff Waddington, serves on the board here, and he's also pastor of Faith OPC in Fawn Grove, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Jeff. It's good to see you today.
Oh, good to be here in this wonderful topic we're going to be discussing, but also the odd weather for February, and even in this part of the country where it's going to get up into the 50s today.
Yeah,
well, in February, yeah. That's you know, we'll get used to that, and then the normal winter weather will come back and slam us.
No doubt it will. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's been, we keep getting that polar vortex these last few years. It gets really cold. It's always gotten cold in Illinois. I know our friends to the north will laugh, but, you know, I laugh at my friends to the south. I know how that works. But the last several years we usually get down to 0 Fahrenheit, you know, for a day or two.
Right.
But now it's starting to get these last 5 years or so, you'll start to get, you know, a week, 2 week stretch where it'll get down there. And it's, yeah, it is what it is. But
it is.
Thank goodness for heating.
Yeah.
Oh, to light a fire.
Definitely. I'm so thank the Lord every day for his provision.
Yeah, I don't like paying the bills, but
staying warm.
I think I'd rather pay the bills than cut down trees. But
personally, that too.
I don't mean existentially or abstractly. I mean just me personally doing the cutting the trees down. I do one or two of those, but then that's about it for me. But that's what they used to do back in the day. We're talking today about Old Princeton, specifically about B.B. Warfield, and we're going to speak about a forthcoming article that Jeff wrote that'll be included in the next issue of our newsletter. If you'd like to get a copy of the print newsletter and you find yourself in the United States, we'll send you a free copy if you sign up over at reformedforum.org/newsletter. Just fill out the form. While you're at it, you can sign up for emails and updates about all the other things we have going on here at Reformed Forum. But this next issue should be a great one. I'm looking forward to talking about Warfield. Jeff, you've called Warfield, in a sense, a Renaissance man. And yes, we're going to walk through some of his works as you demonstrate your case for calling him that. But first off, I suppose, I mean, maybe it's an obvious question, but it's where you start in the article. What do you mean by that? And how is Warfield one of these people, a Renaissance man?
Right. The expression means a person who has studied in a broad range of topics and is thoroughly familiar with them. It's not just, a facile understanding of various topics or disciplines, not so much topics per se, but disciplines. And Warfield, in my opinion, demonstrates his mastery of the whole spectrum of what we would now call, what was called then and we call now, the theological encyclopedia.
Yeah, it's interesting to discuss Warfield, and when you look at his works, depending on the era in which you're looking, you might think he's either a New Testament scholar or a systematician.
Right.
He's somebody that kind of stretches both. I suppose he's done some historical theology as well, as any good theologian would do, but he doesn't fit into one single neat and tidy category. But he isn't exactly like a total polymath in terms of, you know, his written output. But it is much more extensive and broad than we find among most people today.
Yeah. Now he may have, well, because he was an editor of a journal for animal husbandry. He no doubt published things that I wouldn't.
That means raising animals, just in case people don't know the old fashioned term.
Yeah.
He wasn't looking to to get them, the, you know, to make husbands of the animals amongst right. themselves or anything like that.
Yeah, I have no idea why that word is applied to caring for animals, just that it's the care. It's the, sure. the care and breeding, I guess, right? The
I care think it might have more to say about how women view men or something and as their
that
spouse.
Could be. Yeah, men, you know, when as a single guy, you know, we used to say, you know, give me a couch and a field, I'll be okay.
Well, if you go to a dance by yourself, okay. you're going stag, or you're young men are often considered as wild animals, out wild stallions, and then the wife settles them down. They make a husband out of them. So I guess that's what you do with an animal when you're raising them and breeding them. You got to domesticate them. So if you become a husband, maybe that's what right. it means. At least that's what I'm saying it means.
So Warfield. Now, some of that was, he was an editor of a journal on caring, you know, breeding and whatever before he ever went to seminary. So this is either while he's in, before he went to college, during his college, but before he entered seminary. Mm. So because he was born in Kentucky, 1851, dies 1921. So he was 70 years old in rounded numbers when he passed away. Mm-hmm. He comes from, you know, the Lexington, Kentucky area, which is horse country.
Oh yeah.
Bluegrass country. So it's in his blood. So he's also drawn to scientific theory, the latest scientific theories, which of course the big one would have been evolution and Darwin's writings on that topic. And that's one of those ongoing debates. How much influence does Darwin have on Warfield? And of course, that's one of those questions where you have to probably take into consideration at what point in time are you referring to? Early, mid, late, you know, young theologian, mature theologian. There are differences. And for instance, Fred Zaspel in his fine exposition of Warfield's life and theology takes issue with the views of Mark Knoll and David Livingstone and probably Brad Gundlach as well, who see more of a theistic evolutionary view being upheld by Warfield. And Zaspel says that early on, yes, but later on that changed.
Hmm. So yeah, let's talk a bit about his biography, just to sure. set out the stage for Benjamin Breckinridge Warfield. That middle name is important. For those of you who know a little, maybe if you've been listening to Reform Forum for a long time, I used to have a dog named Warfield. We had to put him down. He got old. I think he was 13. So not terribly old, but he was a Cairn Terrier. So this is going somewhere, this story. But we love that little dog. It's Scottish, little Scottish breed. And the Cairn Terrier, for those who don't know, is the breed of Toto in The Wizard of Oz. Now, Toto was a black or darker one. So we had one that was more traditional, kind of tan-ish colored. But if you know that breed and you know the way that their hair grows and how they're often groomed, you know, I thought when we got that dog, I bought the dog for my wife. I said, I'll get you a dog, but I reserve the right to name the dog. So I named it Warfield because I loved some of these pictures of Warfield and his wonderfully manicured beard.
Yeah.
And I thought that it looked just perfect, just like one of these, you know, well-groomed dog beards. So I named my dog Warfield. And that stuck, you know, it's just the name of the dog. So, you know, for my wife and family and other people, you know, they think of Warfield as our pet, not necessarily as this towering theologian, but I did it out of respect. I didn't name, you know, it was a little bit of a joke, but it wasn't out of disrespect. Right. But Warfield had a look to him, but that name, the last name is just, that's just to me a stout, strong right. name. But the middle name as well tells us quite a bit about his family connections and family history, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Breckinridge, so he was related to a significant Southern political and Presbyterian family, the Breckinridges, his he was, I think Robert Breckinridge was his grandfather. And Breckinridge was known as a debater in the councils of the church. He was also known, I believe, as a fighter, as a student at the college and seminary. So Warfield gets himself in trouble at one point, and he's just following in the Breckinridge family mold. He's also, Warfield is also therefore related to John C. Breckinridge, who was the U.S. vice president, and then later in, during the Civil War, a Confederate general. And then the end of the Civil War, he's this Confederate Secretary of War. Interestingly, maybe less well known, is that Warfield is related to Wallace Warfield Simpson, the lover and later the wife of Edward VII, who was king of England and then abdicated the throne. And
the king who quit.
The Duke of Windsor.
So this is Queen Elizabeth's uncle.
Yes.
Who abdicated and then may or may not have been involved in some Nazi affairs later on. There's some suspicion of that and suggestions. But this is when that movie, The King's Speech, that is Edward VII's brother and Elizabeth's father, George. Was George the sixth?
The fifth. George the fifth, who looked like Tsar Nicholas's cousin, was king during World War I.
Yeah.
So that's, and I think he actually, his character appears in The King's Speech. He kind of belittles his son, right? And that may have contributed to the stuttering of King George V.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Warfield's related to Wallace Warfield Simpson?
I had no idea. That was new to me when I read your article.
Simpson, Windsor. Okay, at that point, the royal family had changed their name to Windsor because their name was originally Saxe Coburg Gotha. And during World War One, you're fighting the Germans.
Yeah, it's too many Germans.
So they changed to Windsor, named after the castle. So she becomes a Windsor. And therefore, Warfield, Benjamin Breckinridge Warfield, is related to her, therefore related to the royal family. You think that would give us entree?
Queen is Presbyterian.
There you go.
Is that how that works?
That's bad logic, but hey, let's go with it. So the name of that journal that Warfield was the editor of was called the Farmer's Home Journal. I have no idea how long that journal lasted.
It doesn't surprise me, though. Kentucky, that area is wonderful. And then Warfield's experience there and his varied interests. It's interesting that he was in charge of that.
Now, depending on, there's another related debate among scholars regarding Warfield, and that is the value of his commitment to the Baconian experimental method in science. And it's tied in, it's related to, although just distinct from the question about the influence of Charles Darwin. So Warfield is, of course, not alone. Many theologians in the 19th century bought into the Baconian method, which is experimental. In other words, you have a hypothesis and you test it. That's the Baconian method, and that was transferred from the natural sciences to philosophy and theology. And so we do see some of that in the theology of Old Princeton. Not everyone. You see it more like perhaps in Charles Hodge, and maybe in Warfield. That's another ongoing debate. That if you're going to be a Warfield scholar, one of those things you need to be familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So Warfield enters Princeton College. At that point, later it becomes Princeton University when Woodrow Wilson is president of the school. He enters not as a freshman, I believe as a sophomore. He had advanced standing. So he's already entering into the school with some sort of awareness by others that he's got a good head on his shoulders.
He had all of his animal husbandry courses out of the way.
Exactly. interestingly enough, at the same time as Warfield is entering Princeton College as a student, Princeton is getting a new president by the name of James McCosh. James McCosh. So it's, you see a situation occurring at this point, which was not unlike the bringing over of John Witherspoon to be president of Princeton, which was then called the College of New Jersey. And you see, when McCosh comes to the States, he's best known as a purveyor of Scottish common sense realism, the particular philosophy that he embraced, and he's a theistic evolutionist. So very often, interestingly enough, John Gerstner, who's known as an Edwards scholar, actually did his PhD dissertation on James McCosh.
On McCosh.
On McCosh, not on Edwards. But anyway, so that's a little bit of intellectual history in terms of influences on Warfield.
Was he ordained after his studies? Right into the PC?
He does eventually go through licensure and ordination in the Presbyterian Church USA. But before
the Northern Church.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good point. He's on a border state, Kentucky, right? If you're thinking of the Civil War, it's a state that embraced slavery, but didn't go with the Confederacy. It actually was a state with conflicting commitments. Some, the North and the South both raised troops in Kentucky. Interesting. So it's a border state, but he was a member of a Northern Presbyterian congregation. And so his involvement in the Presbyterian Church was geared toward the North, even though he's from an area known typically as Southern. So his grandfather, Robert Breckinridge, was involved with the founding of the seminary in Danville, Kentucky, where Robinson taught.
Yeah.
So he ends up, he does some European studies, then he goes to the seminary, graduates, goes through licensure and ordination, serves as a stated supply. He may have even been called as a pastor, but eventually he gets a call to teach New Testament at what was then called Western Theological Seminary in Allegheny, Pennsylvania, which I believe is a suburb of, or in the neighborhood of Pittsburgh.
What's the history of that? There's still a Western there in Pittsburgh. Is it the same institution?
Yeah, but it has a different name. I believe it ends up getting absorbed into what is today Pittsburgh Theological Seminary.
Oh, sure. I think that's where Mr. Rogers went.
It was. Fred Rogers went to Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, and it's also where John Gerstner was on the faculty for many years.
Hmm.
The lone conservative Presbyterian. But at the time that Warfield was called, it was still a fairly solid institution. And he taught there for 5 years.
Hmm.
And it's while he's at Western in Western Pennsylvania, I believe that's how the name is. And remember, you're dealing with, if you're thinking about the progression of the American domestication of the country, right? Moving west.
Manifest destiny, brother.
Yeah. At one point, Western Pennsylvania was the frontier.
Yeah. It always confused me why Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois is called Northwestern. Well, if you look at when it was founded, it makes total sense.
The Northwest Ordinance, right? Mm-hmm. The Northwest Ordinance in the United States history has nothing to do with Washington State or Oregon. It has to do with what we now call Ohio and western parts of New York for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, Western Theological Seminary, while there, he wrote a book on New Testament textual criticism, and he co-authored what becomes a book called Inspiration. He co-authors that with his professor at Princeton, A.A. Hodge, the son of Charles Hodge. And that is sort of, we might call it the bridge that then connects him. I suspect the faculty at Princeton had their eye on Warfield from day one, once they knew him personally as a student at Princeton. They had the desire to bring him on the faculty.
Okay, there are two analogies here for the folks. So you're saying that probably the Princeton faculty wanted to bring him on eventually, but they wanted to see him develop and maybe had to wait until a spot opened up. So they treated they were viewing Western as what people might view the NBA to the G League.
Yes,
or another analogy, in international soccer, you've got a young guy, you sign him to a contract, but then you loan him, you don't release the contract, but you loan him to a lesser club, maybe in a different country, so that the person gets playing time and starts to develop. So is he kind of, he's like working out the young scholar kinks at Western, maybe with whether he knows it or not, other people have an eye on him for Princeton?
Right. I've not read anything that suggests that he was aware of this.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't surprise me because he has ongoing letter writing with his former professors at Princeton. So there's correspondence going on. It reminds me of the situation with Voss, right, who would later become a fellow faculty member and personal friend.
And he was in Grand Rapids early on, right? Teaching.
Princeton may have been thinking the same thing with what is now Calvin University and Calvin Seminary. Mm. It was a good training ground for Voss. And then Voss comes along, gets called about 10 years, I think. So Warfield is called to Princeton in the late 80s, 1880s. And Voss comes along about 10 years later, 1898, I think, thereabouts. Mm. And so there's that similarity of an ongoing letter writing relationship with a mentor.
Uh-huh.
Right. In Voss's case, I think it was, who was it? William Henry Green.
Mm.
Who, interestingly enough, was an Old Testament professor.
Old Testament.
Right. Not as opposed to
William Brenton Green, the apologist.
Right, who's the apologist? It's interesting.
And his retirement led to the eventual, election of Machen to that chair, which precipitated all sorts of other events. That's entirely.
And when he got turned down, it was Van Til who filled in.
Yes.
And then Van Til was actually offered the chair of apologetics at Princeton, and then because of all that was going on, he turned it down.
Right.
Little known fact that some people aren't aware of, because that he had the offer of the job at Princeton, mm-hmm. had he wanted to take it. So Warfield, of course, is that bridge generation, right? Between say the Charles Hodge, who's a second generation professor. So Warfield is the third or fourth generation. Voss is, we might say fifth, and Machen is sixth generation, and that's when some of what we begin to see happening in the scholarly world of Warfield and Voss becomes a real problem in the life of Machen. But we see it already. The influence of the German university system, mm-hmm. on American academic education in general. The whole mm-hmm. The Americans had the option, I suppose, and this is not in the article, but it's related. They had the option of adopting the British academic university model or the German, and they went for the German because the German was considered to be the scientific, the premier scientific way of doing things, and the PhD system.
How does that differ from the, is that the American model we know now?
Well, the American model that we know now probably has evolved, but it was definitely the German system.
Got it. Now, this largely has to do with, are you taking structured courses and producing work leading up, or do you, when you matriculate, you basically start on your dissertation or your thesis right away?
I think in the German model, it's, in the British model, it's definitely no coursework
right
for the PhD.
You can piece your own together if you want, but it's not a requirement.
Necessary. Now, so it's a purely a research, what we would call a research PhD. Mm-hmm. The German model actually has two dissertations. It has what's called the habilitation Schrift, which is kind of like your first run.
Yeah.
And then your final. Yeah. Then your rehabilitation Schrift, which is the second. And often both of those get published. So that's the German model. That aspect is not necessarily embraced in America. But anyways, that's the ferment going on. And so all things German academically become a model in the American academic higher education system.
Yeah.
That brings in the theological world, in the philosophical world, that brings with it the influence of say a Kant or a Hegel, mm-hmm. and their acolytes. In theology, it brings the influence of a Schleiermacher and a Ritschl, and others. In studies, it brings the influence of well-known Old and New Testament scholars who are critical. In other words, all of this is to say there's an influence that is not good.
Yeah.
There are some things that are helpful, but there are many things, the philosophical influence, et cetera, that Warfield will find himself battling.
Oh, entirely.
Right. And in the influence in biblical studies, his
scriptures.
He's known, of mm-hmm. course. Yeah. He's known for his work on inspiration and inerrancy. And the reason for that, and I bring this up in the footnotes, Warfield and Hodge with him are often seen as the inventors of the doctrine of inerrancy, especially the Rogers and McKim.
Rogers McKim book, right?
Their thesis is that it's Old Princeton is the inventor, the school of Old Princeton is the inventor of inerrancy, of the doctrine of inerrancy. But I think John Woodbridge in 1982 put that idea to death. Unfortunately, even though it was dealt a deadly blow, it seems to come back to life. It came back to life, in my opinion, in the teaching of Peter Enns. Mm-hmm. And not the only one to see that. Gary Johnson in his book on the writings of his edited book on the uh-huh. on the writings of life and writings of Warfield makes that comparison as well. But this is Warfield's, what he's known for. This is, and so a lot of people, if they know in the evangelical world, if they know anything about Warfield, it's going to be about his writings on biblical inspiration, authority of scripture, inerrancy in particular.
Now, I want to get into his interaction, should we say, his scholarly battle with Charles Briggs. Before that, I want to pick up on something you commented on, because it's been kind of mostly asking for help of you, but also of any listeners who may be able to point me in the right direction. But it's kind of this interesting issue about intellectual influence. And you spoke of scholarly generations of Old Princeton, and that Machen was like the sixth generation. But it's interesting to count that, because let me give an example. It's not as simple. When I'm trying to think of what generation somebody is, and this is largely pertaining to my work as OP historian, because we speak of the first generation, the second generation.
Yes.
It's not cut and dry as it is with physical generation, because you have a parent, and then roughly every 20, 25 years, sociologists, anthropologists, whatever, might categorize generations just strictly by years. But let's take a figure like Dr. Gaffin at Westminster, who began teaching in the late 60s, if I'm not mistaken. So you can have people who went to seminary in the late 60s who are one step removed from Gaffin, having learned from him in class. But a figure like me, who took his last full course he ever taught on Acts and Paul in 2011, 10 or maybe 10, 2010, it's in that ballpark. I'm getting old and forgetting my dates. But, you know, I might be, there might be three generations between the first set of students and me, myself, maybe.
Right.
But when you look at the influence, you know, I sat under Gaffin in the classroom. So there are different ways to count this. So I'm curious if church historians or perhaps more specifically historical theologians have a way of understanding this, if anyone's discussed a taxonomy, because you can have different generations in a sense. You know, I'm not a first generation Van Til student, you know, but I'm basically second generation student, third generation, if you count Van Til the first, you know what I mean? So you can count that in odd ways. And then you could extend the metaphor perhaps to your primary sources, like who are you reading the most, you know? So that might, that might even change things all the more.
Isn't this similar to that game that my daughter has taught me about?
Kevin Bacon game?
Is that what they call it? Six steps removed or five steps?
Yeah. Well, there's that. Yeah. Just 6 degrees.
That's it. 6 degrees of separation.
Yes. But the running joke is that Kevin Bacon has been in so many movies with different people. There were years ago, like 15 years ago, there was even a website that you could type in any actor on IMDb and it would tell you how many steps from Kevin Bacon they were. And
yes,
you could not
I remember that.
You basically couldn't find hardly anyone that had an IMDb credit, like a legit credit, just that was more than 5 or 6 degrees from Kevin Bacon. I don't know if who is the most connected person now, if Kevin Bacon is not that person. And I presume he's not now. I would love to know if anybody knows who's the most connected, most centrally connected IMDb person. Okay, this is getting way off topic, but I would love to know that too in terms of scholarly references. You know, Google Scholar for a while was doing a lot of this where they were running artificial intelligence on footnotes in published books and articles. And it's if you can do that, if a computer could read and then correctly identify the book source in a footnote, which I don't know how to do that, but I mean, as a former programmer, it doesn't sound terribly difficult for someone like Google to figure out how to do that. If you can do that, you could create an entire network mind map of all the scholarly sources and connections. And people have done that. But I would love to just be able to browse a book and click the book, and then it would bring up a network diagram of all of the sources that it links to, and then all of the sources that link to it.
Right.
There's a thing called for scholars called the H score, I think.
What it's called? It's being done with Edwards, with Jonathan Edwards, especially the miscellanies. That it's being visualized. Yes. It almost looks like a brain scan.
Because then you can see Edwards would be an enormous node on that network.
Yeah, and so
a figure like Bart also would be. Kant would be massive.
You're looking at, you know, you're getting into, and it's also being done. You mentioned Google. I was thinking there's another. It's being done. Of course,
academia.edu has a similar.
Yeah, and so you can now. Admittedly, it uses. I don't know if it's sophisticated enough to handle concepts. Or a combination of concepts. Maybe it is. Mm-hmm. Does Boolean logic enter into here? The if then or fuzzy logic?
Oh, well, that
can it expand? Are we beyond that at this point?
Oh, very, very far beyond that.
Okay, yeah. See, yes. I think I'm aware of the work that's being done, but how, you know, what is the computer, the algorithms that are being used to do it are probably well beyond anything that I've. But yes, you've got the question is what is an influence and who is an influence? Those things, because an influence is an article you read.
Exactly.
A book you've read, reviewed, right? So, how do you define influence?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Is it you know? I can say Warfield, not only the those who come before him, but Bovink and Kuyper are in his world.
Mm.
And I mentioned the fact that they all died around 1921 as an interest. It's a loss to the Reformed world, right? Mm-hmm. We're even now still evaluating, getting, translating the works of these giants of 100 years ago, right?
Precisely. Including Warfield.
I was asked by a friend, I mean an acquaintance, to go to the Princeton Seminary Library, the rare book room, and I actually was able, with my little white gloves, to go through and take pictures with my camera at the time. Mm-hmm. This is now like 12, 20, maybe even 20 years ago.
Yeah,
and I took pictures of the Warfield scrapbooks, yeah, because we were looking for two things. One would be shorter writings that had not actually been included in this, and I came to the conclusion that what was of value had been selected. What was left were ephemeral, in other words, things that were of interest back in his day, but as of yet have not become of interest to us. You know, it's just the way it is. That happens, right? Some things are of enduring value. Some things are of value in the day, but not necessarily of enduring value. But what I found, it was interesting to be able to actually look at his personal scrapbooks.
Yeah.
Here I am playing with Warfield scrapbooks.
I know. It's amazing.
And then I also had took pictures of a correspondence that he had with a scholar in England.
Hmm.
And this was for the man who is working on the Warfield biography. And I don't know if I should mention who it is.
Yeah.
I specifically don't mention him by name.
Sure.
Although I can say that he is mentioned
okay.
in the footnotes, I'll leave it at that. And so I still have on my computer the photos that I took of his correspondence, his handwriting. It was not printed or typewritten correspondence. It was correspondence by personal handwriting.
Hmm.
And so that was interesting. So I got caught up. I'm not an expert on Warfield. I'm a student of Warfield.
Sure.
But here I am contributing to one degree or another to the ongoing biographical as well as theological discussion of Warfield's ongoing influence. So we may someday have a biography of Warfield. We may discover somewhere, I don't think you're going to find them in the scrapbooks at Princeton Seminary. What do they call the library? Is it still, what's the name of the library now?
At Princeton?
Yeah. Seminary.
I don't know.
Not the Firestone. The Firestone is at the university.
Oh, sure. I'll remember later. I don't.
Yeah,
I've only been once.
It's Machen's nemesis.
Jim used to steal their. Oh, Speer? No, it wasn't
Speer. Yeah,
no.
Robert Speer.
Yeah.
Robert Speer. It was the library at the seminary was called the Robert Speer Library, and it still was when I was doing this stuff.
I need to finish my sentence so that Jim doesn't get tarnished his bad name. I'm joking. He used to steal the Wi-Fi is what I was going to say. He used to steal the books from the library. He used to, and he had a password, all that, but he would often, you know, he's done a few episodes from the library parking lot.
Yes, he did. I remember that. I was able to borrow books from the library because I took a course on Edwards at Princeton Seminary. But anyways, this was related but unrelated.
Sure. Right?
Warfield's work. So Warfield, the question of who influences him and who is he influenced, who does he in turn influence?
Right.
Well, this generation question is interesting because there's overlap, right?
Yeah, there is.
Warfield is a student of Charles Hodge, who was a second generation. He was among the second generation of professors because he was a student of Archibald Alexander and Samuel Miller. The first two professors, Hodge is the third professor at Princeton. Now, by the time you get to Warfield, you've got a bunch of professors, right? You're up to 10 or 15, maybe even 20. And by the time Machen comes along, it's a larger group,
mm-hmm.
right, of men who are teaching at the seminary.
It might have been 28. 28 or 29.
Even during Warfield's time, right. it's on the way to getting there.
Yeah.
Right. And then Voss is brought on as during Warfield's tenure. So Warfield teaches literally until the day he dies. Warfield has a heart attack on the front lawn of the Voss home.
Mm-hmm.
And then he recovers and goes back to teaching, but then he has another heart attack and dies. At the age of 69.
So, but 70. At that age, he had influenced, and you know.
Oh, in how many students
tremendous
did he
amounts.
Have? That's interesting. Right. I know.
Hundreds that, and hundreds, at least.
Yeah. Hodge was teaching for 50 years, and it was in the thousands. And beyond Presbyterianism, remember that Princeton is one of those schools that is a magnet for evangelicals broadly. Mm-hmm. So James Pettigrew Boyce, who is the founder of Southern Theological Seminary, mm-hmm. in the Southern Baptist Convention, he's a student of Hodge. He's a contemporary. He's an earlier student of Hodge. Warfield is a later student of Hodge because Hodge taught for 50 plus years at Princeton, right? So Warfield is influenced by both those who taught him at the university, at the college, and then at the seminary, which were distinct institutions, although at that point they're cross-fertilizing one another.
Right.
So that Charles Hodge is on the board of trustees of the college, although it's a distinct institution with its own board.
Yes.
And its own faculty.
Always has been.
Although, as I said, at that early stage, they were sharing. In other words, professors at the seminary will often teach classes at the at the college, and vice versa.
Sure,
that may continue even now. That's similar, but they're distinct. They have their own boards, their own administration, their own faculty. And Warfield goes to both the college and the seminary, right? So he's got both, you know, however you know, whatever. So that, and he's a student of Hodge. And he's also a student of A.A. Hodge and Caspar Wister Hodge, who are sons of Charles Hodge.
Mm.
Now, by the time you get to Machen, I think you've got a third generation, and you've got a grandson of Charles Hodge, who also is Caspar Wister Hodge.
Oh, yes. I knew that's what I thought. I was thought I was confused because right? So, I knew a Casper Whisper there's was. There's two Caspar Wister right. Hodges. Okay.
There's there's the son of Charles, and then I think there's the grandson of Charles.
Sure. And he was the one that Machen consulted with
right.
when Machen was deliberating whether to take the chair of apologetics. Obviously, right. he never got it because it wasn't confirmed at General Assembly. Because the president
that's a whole interesting
spoke
story,
against him.
And Warfield fits into that because, as you may remember, right. Machen, who writes regularly to his mother,
mm-hmm.
Makes the comment at the funeral of Warfield that when his body is carried out of the chapel, old Princeton goes with him.
That was 5 years earlier.
Yeah, I mean, right. that's an interesting right. comment to make.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's almost prescient. I'm going to change that to it. It was absolutely spot on.
I wonder if I suspect Machen meant that, but I suspect that the implication wasn't as much that New Princeton was modernist or liberal, although it was something else. But I think after the reorganization of the board in 29, which would have been 8 years following
right.
Warfield's death, I think that statement to his mother takes on a different life. Not one that's contrary to the original intent, but my suspicion is that it grew.
Yeah, it's an expansion. It's and you know as well as I that actually the life of liberal classical liberalism at Princeton is actually short-lived. It very soon, very quickly becomes the haven of neo-orthodoxy.
Mm.
Right, Bardianism becomes more of a influence at Princeton than did classical liberalism.
Oh, absolutely.
So, liberalism has a heyday for a very short while at Princeton. And even today, you go to Princeton, and there's a plethora of views that mm-hmm. are taught. Mm-hmm. You know, my professor for the Edwards PhD seminar often would complain about one of his colleagues because the colleague was a Bartian, and actually was an expert in Bart, and my professor was not a Bartian.
Yeah.
And the academic dean made these two men co-teach a course on the introduction to systematic theology.
It's very dialectical.
And it was, because one week you would have Bart's view or this scholar's view of Bart. And if I gave the name, many would know who he was. And then there is my professor, who's not a Bartian. And so they would be conflicting with each other. And on top of that, you have within the Bartians, you have a conflict between this man who co-taught a course with my professor, who taught the Edwards course. You have him in conflict with another scholar who is a Bartian.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting what happens. Earlier in the days of old Princeton, I think you had variety, but you had confessional continuity among the various professors, just as you did at Westminster, right?
Yeah, entirely.
With the original founding faculty had their differences, but they were cohesive in a way that Princeton could never claim to be now. Right? I mean, it's Princeton Theological Seminary, which is an august institution with lots of money, I suppose, and lots of property.
Mm-hmm.
Although compared to Harvard, it's not. But so it's interesting to see the dynamics at work. So there's a painting of Warfield, just as there is of Hodge, on the walls at the Robert Speer Library. But basically, they're put in a room staring at each other and have little ongoing influence to the current faculty and students, unless you're into old Princeton.
Sure.
Then, like my friend Paul Kios Helseth, who would travel from his school, which is Northeastern, I think it's now a university, but it may still be called the college. It's the college in Minnesota that Billy Graham was president of at one time. So Paul is a scholar of old Princeton. So he treks back to Princeton to do work in the Speer Library. And he used to stay at the Charles Erdman, hall or whatever they would call it, where guest scholars could come and stay while they did their research. If you know anything, you know that Erdman was not only Speer, but Erdman was a nemesis of Machen.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit about Briggs. Speaking of nemesis,
there you go. Yeah, I mean, he's kind of
have Briggs is a huge figure in the Presbyterian Church.
Yeah, right. He's an Old Testament scholar, but he also publishes on the Westminster Confession. There was an attempt to have a journal that was edited by the faculties of both Princeton and Union. That lasted for maybe a year or two, and that was was it A.A. Hodge or Casper Wister? I forget who was the Princeton editor and Briggs was the Union editor. At this point, Union is a Presbyterian seminary, more new school. It's not an old school seminary at all, although it had what's his name, who was an old school Presbyterian. Shed was a professor at Union, but he himself was old school.
Yeah.
Even though the school itself was
the union didn't go well. Well, there are several unions, right? We're talking about the one in New York.
There's union that's in New York, and then there's union that's in Virginia, which is part of the Southern Presbyterian tradition. The union that's in New York just goes.
That one went bananas.
Wonky. A long time ago. So it because of the Briggs situation, among others, it separates itself from the Presbyterian Church and becomes independent, has its own board, therefore at that point has no official connection to the Presbyterian Church USA. And Briggs contributes to that separation. In fact, it may have been because of what happens to Charles Briggs. Briggs ends up becoming Congregationalist. I forget now. He ends up going himself, leaving the presbytery because of it. He's brought, there are charges of heresy brought against him that I believe, I could be wrong here, but are upheld. Therefore, he leaves the PCUSA and becomes a Congregationalist. But he stays, I believe, at Union, and Union separates, becomes separate. But it's because of he has because of his disagreements with the Hodges and with Princeton. And Warfield is in the middle of all this. If you're looking at the ecclesiastical battles that occur.
There's a really interesting account of this whole Briggs affair in Leffert's Letcher's book. Letcher is kind of a new schooler. He's somewhat conservative himself, but he's not favorable towards Machen's party, so to speak.
Right.
But he records the history. Letcher eventually taught church history at Princeton Seminary.
Right.
And the book, I think, was published in 1954, thereabouts, at least one of the editions.
Yeah, you mean The Broadening Church?
Yeah, The Broadening Church. A Broadening Church.
He also wrote a book that I make reference to on the founding of Old Princeton.
Mm.
With Archibald Alexander and the founding of Princeton.
Wow.
So he's actually now there's a father and a son. So I don't want to. I think among the Letchers, with the same name. But anyways, Leffert Letcher has both this book on Archibald Alexander and the founding of Princeton, but then he writes the book on the Broadening Church.
Yeah.
And it's that idea that of course of. Leads to the founding of Westminster and the founding of the OPC. It's that movement that is occurring within the PCUSA that is a problem. And it's there, it's in its earlier phases in the life of Warfield, but Warfield is battling it as well. So Machen becomes a child, if you will, of Warfield, you know, directly or indirectly. They certainly, as Machen said, when they carried the body of Warfield out of the chapel at his funeral, old Princeton went with him. He may have said more than he knew, but he was seeing the earlier phases of what became the fundamentalist modernist controversy.
Sure.
So certainly Warfield and A.A. Hodge write this two-part series on inspiration that becomes a book that then contributes to they're seeing this broadening church movement that Letcher is writing about later. They see the earlier phases of it and they try to fight against it. In earthly human terms, they are not successful. Right? It is not a success. But I would say in spiritual terms, they gave birth to many children who were and are faithful to the gospel and a biblical understanding of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And it is interesting that Warfield, while perhaps unsuccessful in an institutional sense with regard to Princeton and with regard to the PCUSA. He is in our bloodstream, say here in the OPC and in the PCA.
Yeah, certainly.
Warfield is one of our grandparents, if you will. If you think of Machen as the father of the OPC, then Warfield is a grandfather.
That's right? A good analogy.
Charles Hodge would be a great grandfather. Mm-hmm. Right. And so and the influence. And of course, we haven't even really talked about the old school, new school split. Right. Mm. That Princeton is an old school institution, although it was not in favor of the split. It stands with the old school side of the old school, new school split. And Breckinridge, of course, is one of the quote unquote hotheads. In the old school movement.
Yeah. There's an interesting book on that. I forget the guy's name. You have this, but it's the history of the Presbyterian Church in the Federal Union, 1861 to 69.
Yeah, right. I have that. It's in the air, right? Because you're also dealing with political issues in the country. Warfield is in that whole, you know, whirlpool or whatever you want to call it.
Milieu.
Yes, the milieu. And Warfield, as I try to demonstrate in this article, has interests in many areas, both what we would say secular, but all the ones I'm looking at and the ones that are well known are the theological. But even so, he's interested in New Testament, Old Testament originally. He's interested in church history and historical theology. As I show
canon formation, textual canon criticism formation, along with that New Testament work.
So text criticism, canon formation, various doctrines that are in the New Testament. Then he also deals with historical theology and church history. He deals with Calvin and the Calvinist tradition. He deals earlier with Tertullian and Augustine. He even, you know, has popular articles on race relations, and he also writes on the Westminster Assembly. Right, so he's got a volume that he has a two volumes in his Oxford, what I call Oxford, but currently are published, or the last time they were reprinted, it was Baker. Two of those volumes are devoted to what he calls perfectionism, but he's dealing with the German as well as the American forms of what are traditionally called Methodism. But also the Wesleyan, he knows that the perfectionist movement, you know, goes back to John Wesley in England, but it also has its American offspring or children in the Oberlin movement, which was founded at the Oberlin College in Ohio, was founded as a Christian school, but it's in that higher life Wesleyan. They're not really Wesleyan, but they are. They're more, and they're associated with Charles Finney and Asa Mahan, two well-known faculty members, and they are involved with the abolition movement, and they're involved with women's suffrage. So that's the perfection, and oddly enough, by God's providence, I was born in Oneida, New York, and one of the well-known perfectionist movements is the Oneida community. They were a free love community, among other things. What is left over is the silverware, you know, which I have lots of in my home because I inherited that from my parents, but I was born in Oneida. There were a group of ministers who objected to the influence of Charles Finney, because John Humphrey Noyes, who was the founder of the Oneida community, was the convert of Charles Finney. Now, of course, it reminds me of a comment made, I think it was Moody, D.L. Moody, was walking the streets of London, and he comes across this, and I heard this in a podcast, that's why it comes to me, who is walking on the streets of London, and he comes across this bum, a street person. And he says, "Dr. Moody, do you remember me? I'm one of your converts," to which he said, it was either he or Spurgeon, who said, "Clearly you are a convert of mine. You're not a convert of the Lord Jesus Christ, or you wouldn't be in this condition."
That's one way to put it.
That's the milieu, and that's the international Christian milieu in which Warfield is working. Warfield, perhaps, and this is also the debated topic, because Warfield has a wife who is ill, who is often described as an invalid, although Fred Zaspel in his book on Warfield raises the issue that or offers a corrective that it wasn't the whole extent of the marriage, that there was a time when Mrs. Warfield was not an invalid, and he offers evidence to that effect. But at some point she becomes an invalid.
Sure.
And he therefore doesn't stray far from the Princeton campus. So his influence is primarily in his writing and teaching. Mm-hmm. He's not a traveling name. In other words, he doesn't get on a speaker. He doesn't get involved in what we would call the rubber chicken circuit. He's not in the gospel coalition of his day. He's not in Together for the Gospel, those kinds of things. Of what that would be like that. The Chautauqua movement maybe would be a contemporary movement of his time. He's not a part of that. He's not even involved, as far as I can tell, in the what would be something like the Evangelical Theological Society. He's at home, and therefore he's able to do a boatload of reading and writing because of his care of his wife, that perhaps he would not have been able to do if his wife had remained healthy and robust during the length of their marriage. Mm-hmm. He loved his wife. He cared for her. But because of her condition, he didn't travel far and wide. And therefore, we are the beneficiaries, right? You know, the people of his time may have suffered the lack of his public speaking, but we are the beneficiaries because we have so much of his writing. I didn't even make reference to the Banner of Truth volumes that are I think more or less sermons that he preached that are available. So there are several volumes in the Banner of Truth that have been published about Warfield. I didn't even deal with his Order of Salvation volume.
So if someone was asking, you know, just if someone is new to Warfield and you had to give him only three books, what would you say, what would be a good starter and representative of starter to the works of and the thought of and the representative of B.B. Warfield, and what order would you put them in?
Wow. I mean, you know, am I allowed to treat the 10 volumes as a volume?
No.
Because that's what I would do, what I did in the article, which was to draw from. But if I'm looking at, I would say The Emotional Life of Our Lord.
Yeah.
Is an article that's not part of either the 10 volumes or the 2 volume selected. Okay.
So you'd have that. Would you put in work on inspiration?
Yeah, I would do. I would say the inspiration, Revelation and Authority volume, which is volume one of the 10 volume set.
Okay.
Or it's also available when the Oxford edition went out of print, P&R took what it thought were the five seminal volumes and republished them. So when you see like the Inspiration and Authority volume that P&R published of Warfield, that's almost a duplication of the first volume of the 10 volume set, although there are some differences. So there are some things that are in the P&R volume that are not in the Oxford volume, and there are things in the Oxford volume that are not in the P&R volume, which means if you're a real Warfield devotee, you get both.
For sure.
So that's what's going on in that situation. So I would definitely say The Emotional Life of Our Lord, which is a fairly lengthy article. Then you have the Authority and Inspiration of the Scripture, or backwards. I may get that backwards. I apologize. And so a third volume. Wow. Okay.
The Plan of Salvation for an intro might
be. Plan of Salvation issue. Would be a good one if you're wanting to, because he offers such a helpful schematic of how to understand the various approaches of the Christian traditions to the question of how does God save.
I also like his Religious Life of Theological Students, which is a little pamphlet, but that's helpful as good devotional reading and
that's I believe in the selected. It's also available in the selected shorter writings,
but it is
a standalone pamphlet as well.
But those are at least some works that are useful to get folks started. And, you'll have to read the full article that Jeff wrote. It's not lengthy, but it's very thorough and goes through all of these different major works and eras of Warfield's life. And if you'd like to get a hold of that, you can, of course, subscribe over at reformedforum.org/newsletter. Just fill out the form, and for U.S. addresses, we'll mail a free copy of the print edition to you. If you're not in the U.S., you will still receive an email with a PDF download. When you subscribe or fill out that form, you'll also receive links and can quite easily download past editions. And Jeff had an article in the Covenant of Works in our most recent edition. So there's a lot there. So we're excited about the things we have coming up. Big news to announce in future podcasts, we hope, and future emails. But if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so by sending us a note at mail@reformedforum.org. You can hit us up on Twitter, give us a call, whatever works for you. And if you're going to be at the Greenville Conference first week of March, I think, maybe second week, in Greenville, South Carolina, should be at Woodruff Road PCA, if I'm not mistaken. We'd love to catch up with you there. We'll be there and have a table. We look forward to it.
Sure.
Yeah, it's going to be great. But I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.